Welcome to Book Waves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Roddy Doyle, whose latest novel is The Guts. Roddy Doyle is the author of 10 novels, including the Barrytown trilogy, which is now 4 books, The Commitments, The Snapper, The Van, Patty Clark, Ha Ha Ha. There's also a story collection, plays, children's books, screenplays, several screenplays, which we'll go into later. First, let's talk a little about The Guts. This is the return of Jimmy Rabbit, who is a character, main character of The Commitments, and his father, Jimmy Sr., who's main character in all 3 books. You decided to return to this after 20 years.
And it was actually 28 years since I came up with the name Jimmy Rabbit and sent him on his way, you know. So it's much longer than 20 years ago.
There is a story called Two Pints, which seems related.
Two Pints is a separate thing altogether. It's the thing I started doing on Facebook, just a very short dialogue between two men in a pub discussing an event of the day or, you know, the death of a rock star or, Gaddafi's death, things like that. And they're in book form now in Ireland and the UK. But the two men don't have any names. I've never given them names. They're just two men.
The relationship to The Guts, for me, as I was reading about Two Pints, is that there are discussions in The Guts about the death of Gaddafi and current events.
Yeah, yeah. It's the third novel that I've written, or actually the fourth novel that I've written, that basically covers a year in the life of a character. And I'll probably do that again sometime, because it seems like a good way to impose a certain beginning, middle, and end on a novel. And it's a, I suppose, despite ourselves, we kind of round up things in a way. And New Year's Eve has never been a big day in my calendar, but there's all, you can't avoid that kind of clink as one ends and the other begins. The Van, Paddy Clark, Paula Spencer, and this one all followed a year in the life of a character. Well, I'd be listening to the radio anyway and broadly aware of what's going on in the world. But now and again, it just strikes me, that's something these two guys would talk about. Or this is something that Jimmy would be interested in. Whitney Houston dies. Jimmy thinks he hears it on the radio. They're having dinner. It upsets the family, actually, because particularly him.
Roddy Doyle, why did you decide to come back to Jimmy at this point in time?
I think it was something to do with the economic circumstances in Ireland, the collapse of the Irish economy some years ago, and the use of the word recession in the vocabulary again, and economists on the radio explaining what a recession is and its implications for people, I suppose, under the age of 40, maybe, or maybe under the age of 35, who weren't familiar with it. And I created the Rabbit family, Jimmy and his father and his mother and his sisters and his brother, in a time of deep recession in Ireland, when it was so deep that we thought this was normal life in Ireland. And then we kind of climbed out of that hole in the early 90s, and 15 years of relative prosperity followed that. And that became what we thought was the new normality. And then that stopped virtually overnight. You know, every country has its stories about what went wrong. But there was an immediate nostalgia I felt when I was listening to the radio. I don't watch much TV, but when I was listening to the radio, these economists, bright lads, and the radio producers, bright lads and bright girls and men, women, whatever. But there was a certain glee and a certain nostalgia. They were that kind of little bit giddy, because I think they were thinking back to their heydays in the 80s themselves when, you know, they discovered whatever, drugs, magic mushrooms, their own academic brilliance and their future mapped out ahead of them. And, you know, I taught in a high school in a working class district of Dublin in the 80s. And, I mean, I had a very good time as a teacher, but it was nobody's heyday. I mean, it was really quite rough. And I was teaching children to emigrate more times than not. So the approach to this new recession angered me a bit, because I think people were being a little bit glib about it. And I knew it was, and immediately knew it was a new thing, because, for example, I was rearing my children under the impression that there'd be work, that they'd emigrate if they wanted to, as opposed to having to emigrate, you know. And that went. That was gone. Things that we took for granted could no longer be taken for granted, you know. And I could see immediate panic all around me, people suddenly realizing that they couldn't afford their mortgage. And there was even a point during the euro crisis when one wondered whether currency would exist at the end of the day. It doesn't guarantee a good night's sleep, and I'd never actually experienced that kind of anxiety before, even though I wasn't directly worried. I suppose that the bank closures would have worried me a bit, because you wonder, you know, where will I get money? But other than that, I wasn't being, you know, I wasn't under any financial threat. There was no difficulty there. But I could see it all around me. So I thought, what would these characters, how would they be coping in this new recession, having been born and, you know, having been created in the old one?
Had you been thinking about bringing Jimmy back before then?
No, I hadn't. I did bring him back for a short story. I think maybe I started it in 2000, around about then, just for a bit of fun, really. But then I parked him, and that was the end of that. No, I'd no intention of going back to him, really. But having said that, I've written 10 novels now, and there's only one stands alone. There's only one character I've never gone back to, and that's Paddy Clark in Paddy Clark, ha ha ha. The others, either deliberately there and then, or later on, I've gone back to. Paula Spencer from The Woman Who Walked Into Doors, 10 years after I wrote that book, I was looking for some way of having a contemporary novel set during the boom, but not in any way satirical about people being stupid with their money or anyway, I suppose, sneering at things material. So I thought she'd be a good guide. So I decided to bring back that character. But it had never been my intention until the idea struck me. And it was the same with this one.
You have Jimmy years later. Suddenly he's in his late 40s.
Yeah.
And you have to figure out what you're going to do with him.
Yeah.
Is there any personal involvement with the bowel cancer, or where did that come from?
Well, no. Luckily, you know, it's no great confession, but I haven't had cancer of any type. Like a lot of people my age, there were one or two medical moments that turned out to be minor events as opposed to, the big ones. But I suppose even you have a minor medical moment, there's a queue of possibilities lining up, and we're at that age. So cancer as a topic of discussion entered the conversation with me and my friends. We meet regularly for a drink, have been since we were, well, we haven't been drinking since we were 12, but we've known each other since we were 12. I think the drinking started when we were 13. But we meet once a week. It's been an open thing right through children and different work and the rest of it. And about 10 years ago, maybe more actually, cancer suddenly was on the agenda. It used to be football, music, the children, holidays coming up, work. And then cancer was added. There were five of us used to meet around the table. Now there's four of us because one of my closest friends died of asbestosis. And at the same time, two friends, I find out that two of them have bowel cancer. Since then, I've lost other friends and possibly will lose other friends. And others have come through. And I deliberately gave Jimmy bowel cancer because I knew if it was detected early enough, its chances of recovery were very, very high. And I didn't want the book about to be one man's fight against cancer. That's not what it's about at all. But I suppose in a novel you tend to condense life. Even if it's as, naturalistic as you can possibly make it, you're still condensing life. And it struck me that using cancer as some sort of a more dramatic confrontation with middle age, perhaps, was a good idea. And also, it hauls the humour out of Jimmy as well. And his wife is kind of magnificent in her way, the way she responds to it, giving him presents that make him laugh or make him cry, forcing him to acknowledge that he does have friends, People he has remained in touch with or people he hasn't remained in touch with actually do like him a lot, that he isn't a loner in any sense. Because I find an awful lot of them, I know from observation and from discussion, that when I was younger, I used to think women waved goodbye to their friends at a certain point in their lives and that men held on to their friends. But actually, it seems now I got that one wrong, in that women seem to be better at keeping in touch and men aren't. And that an awful lot of men, they come home from work and they sit there. They know people from work and they know people they can text these days or something like that. But when it comes to that continuity of friendship, an awful lot of them have let that go. And I think Jimmy feels he's like that, but his wife nudges him into a realization, no, that's not the case at all. You just have to make the phone call.
And that allows you to bring back a character from The Commitments as well.
Yes, indeed. Two, actually. Imelda Quirk, who's one of the singers, The Commitmentettes from The Commitments, in the first chapter when he tells his father he has bowel cancer in the local pub, or what used to be Jimmy's local pub, he's now moved into a different estate. Imelda is there. And although the reviews of the book have been really, really good, in Britain one or two people were pointing out, well, this is too coincidental that she's there in the pub. But actually, if you understand the way Dublin works, it's not that big a coincidence at all, because a lot of people in Dublin if you're moving, you either move very, very far or you stay very close to where you grew up. I live 4 miles away from where I grew up. Jimmy probably lives 2 miles from where he grew up. A lot of people stay, and a lot of people I used to teach, men and women in their 40s and nudging into 50, they still live in the area where they used to go to school. And in a large suburban pub, you know, it's very much in, within the bounds of possibility that you would encounter people, either even at my age, people I went to school with, and certainly people I used to teach. So he meets Imelda, and then I thought at one point, I wanted to bring one more character back in, Outspan Foster, the guitarist. And I needed a good reason to bring him back in, or a good entry. So Jimmy has been through chemotherapy, and he's waiting for the elevator to rescue him, to get him out of there. And there's somebody standing beside him, and he said if it was outside the hospital, he would have thought somebody was getting ready to pick his pocket. And he then sees that the guy looks a bit familiar, and it turns out to be his old pal, Outspan Foster, who he's lost touch with and hasn't seen in more than 20 years. And he's there because he is also having chemotherapy. So friendships start at chemotherapy.
Aoife, the wife, hasn't been in anything before, has she?
She is a name in the van. Jimmy is rather largely absent in the van, the third of the Barrytown books. He is going out with this girl called Aoife. The sense is that she's a bit middle class, that he's moving up in the world. And the father's sense of her is that she's great, you know, that he really approves her. Too good for the son, you know, they're at that point in the relationship. So her name is in the van. I didn't know she was going to become a character.
And the character of Les, the brother, the split between the brother and the family, that had happened in the van as well,
yeah. He's in the snapper, and he's kind of a bit of a wild teenager, and the wildness really gets out of control a little bit. And in the van, because the police are interested in him, the parents kind of get him out of the country and send him across to England on the ferry. And he stays, it's only a few days, with, I think if I remember correctly, Jimmy's aunt, Jimmy's mother's sister. Jimmy's forgotten all about him, really. Jimmy can't remember the sound of his voice or what he looked like because of the bowel cancer and the hereditary nature of it. He wants to get in touch with Les, but also because he thinks perhaps his days are numbered. He wants to round things off, and Les arrives almost like a guilt, you know. So he, using Facebook, tracks down Les, but then there's a sense that other family members are way ahead of him. That even though he thinks he's discovered Les, they discovered him quite a while ago.
They just didn't tell him.
Yes. And I mean, again, there was somebody last night was asking me, why isn't it clearer? It's not clearer because life generally isn't clearer. I think it's better left unconcluded, if that's a word. It's open for people to interpret any way they want. Jimmy feels perhaps that he's been so, you know, bloody self-centered that he never got round to looking for his brother, whereas others have.
Roddy Doyle, you're coming back to Jimmy now, and you got to give him a job. You decide to give him this gig of working on websites that sell, I guess, nostalgic music.
Yeah. It was almost inevitable that any job I gave him was going to be under pressure in the recession. He was a car salesman for years. If he had been a car salesman in the guts, he'd have been an ex-car salesman possibly, because those sales rooms were closing down all over the place. They may be reopening now, but they were closing down and people were hanging on to their cars that bit longer, no longer obsessed, you know, a bit of common sense in many, many ways, but unfortunately it resulted in loss of jobs. But his real love is music, of course. And then again, nudged on by his wife, he discovers this way of making a living. He is up in the attic getting something down from the attic and finds his old singles, his old 45s, and he hands them down to the kids. They haven't a clue what they are. They might have had an idea of what an LP looked like, you know, 33, but they've no idea what these singles are, and he shows them to them. And Aoife, the wife, says, would other people be like you? And he says, what do you mean? You know, a bit obsessive about holding on to these things. They discover this idea between them clicks. So they form a kind of a boutique version of iTunes where people, you know, when the boss isn't looking or Googling to see what happened that band they went to see in 1978, they are invited then to go into this and they see that the two singles are on sale. And he reunites these bands if they're still alive and talking to one another as well.
It almost sounds like an idea that could happen, that could be real.
Oh, I'm sure it has and does. You know, somebody must get these bands together because, you know, we know the famous ones that fill the stadiums, but, I mean, I go to this rock festival once every year and there's always, you know, there's the brand new music, but there's always these guys in their 50s and 60s. The urge to get up there must be, you know, must be fantastic, actually, if you've been out of the spotlight or been out of the business for 25, 30 years and then somebody gets a phone call and says, you know, kids are listening to that single you had in 1983, do you want to do a tour? It must be great.
Now, you combine real and fictional bands.
Yes.
Is the rock festival at the end the one you're talking about?
Yes, the Electric Picnic, and it is a real event, and it occurs every late August, the last weekend in August, I think, or sometimes the first weekend in September. I missed last year because I was working in London, but the previous five summers, previous five I'd been to, including the one where Jimmy is at, so the bands that he goes to see with his friends are some of the bands that I went to see.
Were the characters of Barry and Connie slash Brenda, were they in earlier books? Was that great?
No, they're an invention. I had great fun making up that music. It's all fictional. I really enjoyed that. It allows the silly side of your imagination to full reign, you know.
We talk about the Barrytown trilogy, now four books. What is Barrytown and why is it, I guess, emblematic of what you're talking about?
Barrytown is actually a song by Steely Dan. When I was writing The Commitments, I had them in this, you know, working-class suburb of Dublin. And I grew up in a working-class suburb called Kilbarrick. And I taught there as a teacher. And I didn't want to use the name Kilbarrick. I didn't want people to think that I was, you know, looking at them and writing these characters, because I wasn't. You know, inspiration, yeah. But, oh, you know, we're inspired by so many things. So, you know, it was on the main line, I suppose, the equivalent of the BART, the DART in Dublin area, rapid transit. It hugs the coast. You know, Dublin is on the coast and kind of hugs the coast. And there's a Harmonstown and there's another, you know, old villages that have become part of the city. And I don't know why exactly, but Barrytown fit the bill because Barry is an Irish name from the south of Ireland, you know. And, you know, Barrytown, it just fit. As in London, like Kentish Town and Camden Town, it just fit. So I decided I'd call the place Barrytown and give it the dimensions I wanted it to have. So it's broadly in the same place as Kilbarrick. The two men who I co-wrote the screenplay of The Commitments with, the movie, they got into a taxi when they arrived in Dublin Airport and asked the taxi driver to bring them to Barrytown. And they spent hours trying to find the place because it disappeared. It's a bit like Glockamara, I suppose. It was somewhere between Bayside, a real place, and Kilbarrick, a real place. And they couldn't find it. They turned left and it was gone. They couldn't pin it down, you know. And it was before sat-navs, which would have put them right immediately, because actually the nearest Barrytown is in Wales. And then there's one in upstate New York and another in New Zealand. So the name has been great. I think I've used it in about six or seven of the 10 novels. It's just my fictional home. Don't have to describe it. I think it would be a mistake to describe it or to map it or to say, there's the church, there's the bar, there's the bookies, there's the supermarket. That would be a mistake, I think. You'd never read my stuff and then and be able to map it out because it doesn't exist really in left or right. I will now and again do left or right to give the thing a sense of reality, but I've never pinned it down. I put the dart line running through it for convenience. I've often put it near the sea again. It is Dublin, so you're never too far from the sea. As my father said, you can never get lost in Ireland, really. You'll eventually meet the sea. That's what Barrytown is, just a working-class suburb.
And you can go back to it because as life changes, Barrytown changes.
Yes, and I don't have to explain it. As a writer, sometimes it's hard to measure a good day's work. It really is. Sometimes 1,500 words seems like a good day's work, but when you read them later, you realize, no, it wasn't particularly good day's work at all. And sometimes little decisions that seem just like, you know, the work of a few seconds seem like a good idea. I can't remember the exact time when I decided this Steely Dan song would make a good Dublin suburb, but that was a good day's work, you know, because it served me really, really well.
Roddy Doyle, this book and all of your books, you have a preponderance of dialogue. Where did that idea come from? How did that emerge in your earliest work? And why do you focus in on dialogue the way that you do?
I make my rules and then I abandon them and go on and make new rules. But I think the rules that have stayed with me, if you like, I decided for myself in the early stages of writing what became my first novel, The Commitments. The Commitments are a band, a soul band, and I decided on the genre because I like the numbers. There were other possibilities as well. You know, the Black American Forum on top of Dublin, I thought could be... there was great fun to be had with that, I thought. But the numbers just appealed to me. I suppose I was teaching, I was in my seventh or eighth year of teaching when I wrote the book. And the sheer numbers in a classroom generally appealed to me as well. For some reason, I was never intimidated by a room full of 17-year-olds. Never at all. I enjoyed their company very, very much. And I began to imagine them later on. And in fact, I was beginning to see them later on. You know, I would have bumped into students of mine in their mid-20s by then, you know. I meet them, they're in their 50s now, some of them, you know, bald grandparents. So once I decided I'd go for a soul band, the central character is one man. But then he gets this guy, another guy, another guy, another guy, three women to sing backing vocals, and an old guy to play the trumpet, another guy to play the saxophone. The numbers get going, and I was, you know, trying to capture this in the first draft of the book. You know, it struck me very, very quickly, the only way you're going to bring life into this thing is to get them talking, keep them talking, keep them talking. That's why I loved teaching, you know. It wasn't that it gave me the opportunity to talk. It actually gave me the opportunity to listen. And to be able to get the balance right between doing the job, which was the teaching, and actually enjoying the company of the people that you were teaching. And really, there were days when it was heaven, you know, it was just such a, wow, this is, I'm getting paid for this. That was in the early years now. So having decided to, you know, have a band with a lot of numbers, when it came to the young women arriving in the band, other than the young lads being really almost intimidated by the arrival of these three women into the room, I wasn't going to stop and describe them physically. They're just women. And the men are the men, and so the women walk in, and the tension is enough, the fun and the raucousness, that's plenty. And the fact that they say that Imelda is gorgeous is fine for me. I don't really need any, you know, proof. So I don't go in for hair colour, eye colour, height, or anything like that, unless it really fits, unless there's a real reason for it. They're living a working class estate. Am I going to spend pages and pages describing that? And if I am, why? It just gets in the way. As I was writing the book, it became more and more apparent to me that the life of this book is in the characters talking. The half sentences, the interruptions, sometimes it didn't matter who was talking. If I knew, that was fine. It's very tightly done, and a lot of editing, and a lot of red ballpoint. But having finished that book then, I was very happy with it. I started another one almost immediately. It became The Snapper. And it's more introspective, because it's about one young woman. But again, it struck me, the way to tell the story is either to have her talking or not talking, but have it as if it was a movie. And this would have been before handheld cameras were an option, I think. It would have been a handheld camera very close to her shoulder, right through the thing. And if you do that, then the language of the book comes very, very close to spoken language. That's the way that particular book went. And I haven't abandoned that really since. I wrote three books that I suppose could be considered historical, and there's more descriptive work there because they're in a different time and place, and there's a historical context that needs, if not explaining, it needs inclusion, that's for sure. But again, it's in the words of the central character. And as I wrote these books, I suppose into the second one anyway, I really began to enjoy it, you know, I really began to enjoy the dialogue and the challenge of putting words that seem close to speech on paper so that they could be read without too much difficulty. They wouldn't be too much of a challenge. Half sentences that almost as if they're transcribed. But that's the trick. If you do transcribe real speech, it is almost incomprehensible. But if you work at it very, very carefully, it can seem comprehensible, and that's the main thing.
Well, on top of that, I noticed throughout The Guts that there were very, very few places, given all the dialogue and all the characters, there were very few places where I didn't know who was talking.
Yeah. All I can say is that that is the job. Yes, so it's not, you don't just write everything down and then do a little bit of tweaking. You actually hack away at it. I was going to use it, I thought it might be a little bit pompous, but if I was ever doing a writing class, I would show people the red ballpoint that I used while editing The Guts, and it's actually empty. I used all the ink from a from a brand new ballpoint pen, a Bic. It's empty, there's nothing left in it. I was really pleased when I noticed, you know, oh, it's unusual enough that the pen survived on my desk for so long, given that I had a couple of kids in high school at the same time. I used up the red ballpoint or biro an awful lot, and I kind of work it and work it and work it.
Are you typing into a computer, printing out, marking it up, typing it?
Yeah.
In? Yeah.
Yeah.
There's also the different voices. I mean, each person has a different way of speaking.
Yeah.
And that becomes very clear, for instance, when he's talking to his father or to his children.
Yeah. There are generational differences, really. The most extreme example would be the teenage daughter, Mahalia, or May. I don't think it's unique to Dublin or to Ireland, but the word like infects everything that a teenage girl will say. Boys to a degree, but girls particularly. And if you're not familiar with it, if you're in a room full of teenage girls, as I am constantly because my daughter would bring her friends home, and they're in the kitchen and they're yapping away, and they're very, very bright, funny, sarcastic kids, and very loving. They, you know, they love one another's company. But if you're actually listening, sometimes all you can hear is the word like, and oh my God, now and again. Like. And if you were to transcribe it, you'd think, God, what happened to the English language? It's disappeared without trace. But then when you start dropping the likes, when you don't hear them, because, you know, they're very, very bright kids. So when I was trying to write Mahalia's dialogue, and I did it as accurately as I could at first, it's unbearable to read, really unbearable. It's just so much work and the like. So I took away about 90% of the likes and left a token few, which are still quite a lot, to represent the real ones. But that decision to abandon most of the likes was, and again, another good day's work, because I was very keen that that kid be a real sparky character in the book.
And I also noticed that the older men curse a lot, but the women curse less, and the kids much less.
The kids don't curse in front of their father. They will, but they don't. They're not at that point yet where they feel, what would you say, qualified? Well, the father curses in front of them. But then again, he's got bowel cancer, so he'd probably get away with quite a lot. You know, he grew up with it in the house. They aren't to the same extent. Jimmy married up, so to speak. He's married a more middle-class woman.
Well, she's always saying, watch your language to him.
Yes, and actually Jimmy grew up in a house where there was a swear box on the kitchen table, but it was the mother conceded defeat quite early on. If I was to write a book about a group of young women, as I did say with The Snapper, you know, the circumstances would be different, and the curse words or the industrial language would, that quota would go way up. And words that we all, you know, that people of my generation would have thought that these aren't words that women use, they do. And those words would be there as well. And it's always quite a shock when I hear women using some of the more offensive words, really, you know. It's always quite a shock, not in any moralistic sense, but it's something I never expected.
Roddy Doyle, you've got these books with all this dialogue, and you worked on the screenplays for The Van, The Snapper, The Commitments, and also you've written plays. Does it translate easier for you than, say, it might for a writer who focuses on description?
I haven't actually adapted a piece of work for the screen in quite a while, or a piece of my own work anyway. My nearest memory is adapting The Commitments for stage. It's a musical now on the West End, and I did that job. It's funny, you would have thought you could just take out a belt of dialogue and, you know, put it down. But no, reading and watching are very, very different things. And the dialogue actually in prose is more loaded. You know, particularly if you don't have many descriptive passages, it carries a lot more heft or a lot more weight. Whereas, you know, if you're watching characters on stage, you've got the characters for a start. You've got the quality of the actors, their youth or their age, their outfits. Perhaps the dialogue on stage isn't as weighted. Now, every word counts, but it doesn't quite carry the same amount of weight. That's why, in a way, literary decisions, the decision to put a word on a page, is that bit more, it's a 6-inch nail, perhaps, whereas the word on the stage is a tack. I'm not sure, the analogy is a bit daft, but it just struck me there, and it works to a small degree.
Why do you think that is?
I'm not sure. I think it's because the absence of anything else except words on the page. You know, when you're writing a screenplay, if it's made, maybe if you're lucky, 50 people will read it. If you're really, really lucky, a couple of million people will see it.
And then a lot of it might be improvised on screen anyway.
Well, I hate that. What's the point in writing good lines if an actor comes in and decides, I can do better than that, you know?
Roddy Doyle, what is skin in the game?
I'm not sure why you're asking me the phrase.
Well, you worked on documentary, right?
Yes, I did. I wrote two short, or a series of short passages for, it was about the artistic response to the recession. And skin in the game was a phrase from finance that about people having skin in the game. Money invested in this, you know, collapsing structure. And that's, I think, what it meant. It was a great phrase. But you caught me on the hop a bit because I'd forgotten all about it.
Were you working on that while you were writing The Guts, or did that come
from? It was a small, I know the documentary maker, and he asked me to write, I think it was five, very, very short inserts. So I had the voice of a man who's driving around Dublin. The car used to be a company car, but there's no company. And he's driving, he's the same, if you like, habit of work, but there's no work to go to. And his whole life is diminishing, it's shrinking. And he hasn't quite got around to going home to announce. And then there's two young lads at the very beginning choosing places they'll emigrate to, trying to make an adventure of it. And they're mentioning all these far-flung places, you know, these exotic places. Buenos Aires is mentioned, I think. And they decide on London, because it's not so far away. And I didn't want it to be, you know, some sort of attempt at a 19th century depiction of emigration, because they'll have Skype and Ryanair flights home and things like that.
Right.
So there are little creative attempts to give human, you know, human voice to what was going on.
Roddy Doyle, there's a scene where they travel up to Belfast. You know, it got me thinking, that little bit about going up to Belfast to look for Buzz Lightyear, it got me thinking about all of the troubles that had gone down. And here they are driving, and it's no big deal. Have things changed that much?
Oh, dramatically, it's unbelievable, really. You know, the first time I was, maybe I was 19 or 20, the first time I went to Belfast, I mean, there were searches, and the whole city centre was cordoned off, and I remember myself and a friend wandering down the Malone Road, which was a relatively middle-class area near the university, but a car brake screeched to a stop, and it terrified us behind us, because, you know, what was going to happen? Whereas if that happened in Dublin, it's just a car braking, you know? So we were really far from home. And this was at the height of the Troubles. This would have been the late 70s, you know, when people were being abducted off the street and most horrible things happening to them for the simple reason that they may have, you know, they were, you know, Catholic or Protestant. When you came to the border, if you were driving up until relatively recently, you knew exactly, because there was a checkpoint, and it might take quite a considerable time to get past it, and there was an army surveillance on top of a hill to your left, and then the quality of the road changed. You went from a really quite bad road in the Republic, and you went onto a motorway when you crossed the border, you know. Now, for people who'd never stopped, were never stopped at the border, you wouldn't really know. You'd be deep into Northern Ireland, perhaps when you realise that the signage is not in kilometres but in miles, and perhaps then when you stop off to buy something, you want your sterling, although they will take euro as well. But the differences, the cultural barriers, if you like, there will always be some, you know, obviously, you know, the East Coast, West Coast of the United States, or, you know, the South and the North, there will always be differences, and long may it last. But those hostile differences, while they might still be there, it's hostility with the small h, and maybe even, you know, less than that as well. Belfast is a two-hour drive from my front door, and actually shorter if the traffic is kind. It was always that way. But now it feels like a two-hour drive, where it used to feel as if it could be a couple of days away. I'd have felt closer to New York than I would have done to Belfast in many, many ways, because I felt more familiar with it. Now I'm a relatively frequent visitor to Belfast. It doesn't really matter. I actually like going up there.
So at this point, the Troubles are really behind.
One would like to say, it's always silly to consign these things to the past, because there were riots during the summer, you know, about the flags. That'll always, forever, to my mind, be baffling, really. The right to wave flags, or the right to march. What are grown men doing marching anyway? But at the same time, I don't want to dismiss it, because it has huge cultural significance. It just doesn't for me. And yet, it's, again, as I said, it's only up the road. But the right to march, and the right to march down certain streets, and the right to have a Union Jack outside one building or a tricolour outside another building, you know, it all sounds daft to me. Mind you, then, if I was walking through Dublin and I saw a Union Jack hanging from a building and it wasn't the British Embassy, I think the old Republican in my blood, you know, Republican, an Irish Republican, probably if I had hair, it would be standing at the back of my neck and I'd be wondering, what's that doing there? So I think it is there, all right, but no, times have changed.
When people in Ireland look at American politics, are they scratching their heads and going, you Americans are nuts?
No, it's all a bit familiar, really. You know?
Really?
Yeah, I think you inherited the system from us. So we just, you're welcome to it, really. You know? No, it is a bit. You know, when you hear
The story, the scale is different, I suppose. There's something really impressive, say, about a politician blocking a tunnel so that he can get his own revenge on another politician, as happened in New Jersey. And I think a lot of the politicians in the Republic of Ireland would love that sort of clout. But all they can do is, you know, overturn a wheelie bin in somebody's constituency and hope for the best, you know.
I was online earlier today, and I saw articles that you're planning to collaborate with a player from Manchester United on his autobiography.
Yeah, well, he's an ex-player, Roy Keane. Anyone Irish and anybody actually who loves football will know who I'm talking about. But I'm not planning it. We are doing it. I love football. I never describe myself as an author because I think it's too limiting. You know, whenever I have to describe myself, say, in a form or anything like that, it's writer. By and large, my bread and butter, my job is writing novels. But if the opportunity arises and it seems like something that's worth doing, or perhaps in a childish sense, and I like that childish notion, once in a lifetime, I'll do it. So out of the blue, having done the musical, which again was a once in a lifetime thing, to watch the whole thing coming together, I got this invitation, would you be interested in working with Roy Keane? And I'm not a Manchester United supporter, which I think is an advantage, you know. Never had aspirations to be a footballer after the age of 12, and that's an advantage as well, I think. So we're collaborating, we're working together on this book. It covers, there's already a volume on his football life, if you like. So this is more about life after football. What intrigues me, I won't talk too much about it because it's not written yet. It is being written. And I suppose we're talking about two people now, and I'm not for a second talking on his behalf. But I think what happens to sports people is that they're confronted with many senses of redundancy, if you like, way earlier than the rest of us are. So they're forced into notions about retirement and pension and what will they do for the rest of their life, which is quite a considerable time. And that's what really interests me about this particular project, because it must be a really, really quite a shocking thing when you're a world-class footballer, as he was, and your life then is measured according to perhaps earnings and trophies. And that stops. So what happens after that? And that, to an extent, is there's a lot more in it, but that's what drew me towards it.
And it's going to be written in his voice, right?
Yes, that's the challenge, very, very much so.
That's a new challenge for you.
It is, yeah, and a lot of transcribing and a lot of listening. It's as if the analogy, with a fictional character, you build them up with words. In this case, the character arrives with all the words. And he's from the south of Ireland, so they talk very, very quick down there, you know. He crams a lot of words into the average minute. So it's trying to find his voice, but not to be listened to, but to be read. Some halfway house between his spoken voice and a written version. And that's the challenge.
Roddy Doyle, I was looking also online. I saw a review of The Guts, and it suddenly struck me that this reviewer had hit on something in your writing, which was really interesting. He said, Doyle gives us not the moment of confrontation, but the moment of consequence. Mm-hmm. And I noticed that happened over and over in The Guts.
Yeah. Jimmy, for example, is looking for the opportunity to tell his wife that he has cancer. And the opportunity isn't really there. It's a three-bedroom, semi-detached house with four children. A lot of life in that house in the evening time. So he doesn't get the chance to tell his wife. And the next time we see them together, he has told her. I find that interesting, really, you know, the build up to it and then post it, because I think the expectation is that you'll get the event. And of course, it's not avoiding as such. It's not being, oh, I'll skip it now because I don't want to do that. It's in a way a better form of storytelling. I think soap opera, good and all as it can be, is that moment when he tells her. Perhaps literature, at the risk of sounding pompous, goes at it from a different angle, really. And you try to go for a more interesting angle. Things are sloppy. I really work hard at the shape and the appearance of the book on the page, and I try to make sure that everything is accounted for, but I still leave it sloppy. So Jimmy misbehaves, he gets away with it. A lot of people are annoyed with that. They don't know why there aren't consequences. If there were consequences for everything we do, life would be unlivable. It really would be unlivable. We get away with stuff, really. We chance our arms. We occasionally misbehave. We might get drunk, and strictly speaking, if there was some sort of God, he'd send us out in the middle of the road so we'd be hit by a truck for our sins. But we get home, you know, and we wake up the next morning perhaps feeling great instead of feeling awful. And other times we feel awful when we actually should be feeling great. So I do keep it sloppy because I think life is.
Roddy Doyle, it sounds as if you have your next project, which is this biography. Have you started thinking about a book, number one? Number two, do you ever plan to come back to Jimmy Rabbit and his family?
I don't plan, but they're there if I want them to be. I don't know, really. I've a couple of contradictory ideas for a possible novel. I'm not going to do it until later in the year. It's the first time, actually, in my working life that I haven't been working on a novel, really. I generally start one immediately after I finish another one, and I'm normally deep into one when the last one is published, but this time it's different for various reasons, the musical and now the Roy Keane book. So this is new for me. I'm not anxious about it. I have a few ideas. Some of them might involve old characters, others brand new characters. The time, I think, to start wondering about the next book is when I'm coming to the end of this, the one I'm working on at the moment. Then I'll start taking notes, but given that I have to deliver the book in late June, and I would imagine April, May and June are going to be pretty frantic, I don't think I'll be too busy over the summer months, so it might be September before I care, really, about what the next book is.
You've been listening to an interview with Roddy Doyle, whose latest novel is The Guts. The Commitments is still playing in London, correct?
Yes, it is, and hopefully we'll stay for a while.
I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.